Roundtable Osteuropa. Ein Podcast des Zentrums für Osteuropa und internationale Studien.
Welcome to the Roundtable, in which we will discuss some of the big concepts that we've already been using throughout the day. We've given the Roundtable the title Post-Socialism, Post-Communist Transition, Global East? ? That's very important. Conceptualizing legacies of change since 1989. And it's my pleasure to welcome three panelists for this discussion. I start with you, Tatjana. Professor Tatjana Thelen is an anthropologist. She's based at the Institute of Cultural and Social Anthropology at the University of Vienna. And she has worked and written extensively on the economic consequences of reforms in Eastern Europe, especially, but not only, on property relations and social inequality. Countries that she has written on are, for example, Hungary, Romania, but also Serbia and the GDR, or as a part of a country, perhaps. And the research focus has switched more recently to issues of care and welfare and kinship relations, but also, and she's probably in her own writings closest to the topic of this roundtable, also a critical engagement with the term post-socialism. And we'll come back to that in a moment. And next to her is Dr. Juliane Fürst, a historian. She's based at the Center for Contemporary History in Potsdam. She co-directs a research area there on communism and society, and is involved in a big project, which I think is relatively new, on legacies of communism. So there we are with the legacies of communism, not yet quite post-communism and post-socialism, but I think there will be a lot of interesting links between the two ideas that we can discuss. Juliane was a reader in modern history at the University of Bristol before she moved to Potsdam, and she has written books on, for example, Stalin's Last Generation, on Soviet post-war youth, but also on different communities dropping out of socialism, so maybe we can get back to that as well. And she's completing currently a manuscript on the hippie generation in the late Soviet Union. And next to her is Professor Margareta Balmaceda, a political scientist, a professor of diplomacy and international relations at Seton Hall University. She's also an associate of the Davis Center at the Harvard University. And she's also, I'm happy to say, a member of the Zois Academic Advisory Board. And her research and teaching has been on different aspects of East European politics, with a particular focus, I think it's fair to say, on energy issues, energy dependence, energy interdependence, and both domestic and external issues around energy, with a particular focus on Ukraine, Belarus, and Lithuania. My name is Gwendolyn Sasse. I'm the director of Zois, and I have the pleasure to listen to you now while I ask the questions. And we're dealing with very big concepts, and I would like to ask you all individually at first, what concept or concepts do you really like or particularly dislike? I mean, you can take a pick. When we talk about these last 30 years since 89 or 91, depending on where you and if you even want to set a particular starting point. I think what will be really nice about this discussion is that we have three different academic disciplines represented, and I'm not saying everybody is restricted to these disciplines, but I think in particular with regard to these issues, there are distinctive questions and methodological approaches, and I think this will probably come out in our discussion. So that's why I'm very excited about this round here. Tatjana, can we start with you?
Okay, yeah, thank you very much for the invitation indeed. And you asked us beforehand to think about one concept actually, so I have not some comparative thoughts about all four of them, but I picked actually the one which is most prominent in my discipline and was also used today, which is post-socialism. So I understood your question and the invitation, also as you said this morning, as an invitation to think about the epistemic value as well as the fallacies in our theoretical conceptualizations. So the question would be, what do specific concepts make us see, and what do they hide by highlighting specific aspects? So for me, that's a question of what is a kind of a proper comparison, like are we comparing apples with pears, but rather how concepts or ways of producing knowledge by being a heuristic device shape our perceptions and context, but also what we usually call reality itself. So some of the discussions this morning already pointed into that direction, and I will take up some of the issues that have been raised. And I stick to post-socialism, but one could easily make, I guess, the more or less same arguments for the other terms. So most of the speakers have taken the concept up as an empirical or heuristic device, searching for similarities and differences during the last 30 years in a specific set of countries. And this shows already one of the things a concept does, and this one also, it homogenizes phenomena under one label. And one speaker today, this morning, said he would not care what label that is if the content remains the same. And I would like a little bit to caution against such a notion of what concepts do, but because I think we need to be very attentive to the work they actually do. So one first observation is what this concept does, post-socialism, turns into a geographic region. And this is not self-evident, since post, in the first place, seems to be a temporal denominator. So which would invite, and partly does invite us to debate, the appropriate periodization. And we had some of these questions also today. So this includes asking, as has been done this morning, what is the proper starting point and when does it stop? And what marks then the end of post-socialism? So but how did it become then, if it is essentially a temporal term, a regional concept? And furthermore, how can a set of countries be defined as characterized by something that is absent, namely socialism, and with what effects again? In short, I would argue it allows for a specific deficiency analysis with the character of an ambivalent Orientalism. And I say this kind of bold statement before, and I would have some arguments for them, and as long as you let me talk about it, I will go on, and otherwise just, you know, stop me. So, socialism could, of course, be researched as a set of ideas, a political identity or practice, but also as a kind of economic political organization. And in the discussion this morning, but also more broadly, it is most often taken up as the political formation of socialism in the former Soviet Union and its allies. And this is kind of taken for granted starting point. So the similarities seem to be located in a set of political and economic organizational features, which I'm not going to repeat here. I think we all know them. And in short, specifically in Europe, essentially, what was the notion is that there are living the same people within a regrettable, inefficient, economic and unethical political institutional setup. And this kind of homogenizing tendency makes the actually polymorphic nature of socialist transformations vanishing out of sight and feeds into the analysis. So there is a legacy of socialism which feeds into what is then today called the legacy of post-socialism in conceptual terms. So at the time, the transformation in the aftermath of the collapse of state socialism in Europe privileged action-oriented research and theoretical approaches. And as a result, modernization theory, which had previously actually been deemed failed, experienced an unexpected revival. Similar to the changes and upheavals in the post-colonial era, many political actors regarded a Western model of development as a goal and ultimate outcome of post-socialist transformations. So this story is, I think, you know, the normal story. In contrast, but how is this possible if a theory that is deemed dead, you know, experienced this revival? And I would argue that in contrast to the post-colonial societies at the beginning of the transformation process at least, post-socialist societies were considered kindred, so structurally similar enough for the West to envisage a successful realization of the modernization process based on this old paradigm. This construction of the initial sameness in contrast to another stimulated a broad reception of economic analysis. As this initial optimism for a quick adjustment to Western standard failed, culture or mentality began to increasingly being used, very much like an earlier analysis of post-colonial transformations, as a residual category for explaining the apparent failure to produce Western-like conditions. Relying on such an analysis of socialist economies, generally perceived as deficient, becomes then responsible for path dependency, for various drawbacks, or what eventually then was sometimes called a failed transformation, and we discussed this morning if it is failed or partly a success and so forth. So I have one more point to make and then I will stop. So in addition, the collapse of state socialism also had global implications, which then sometimes remained under this regional radar. So this is a kind of a second consequence. So the day in the morning, at one point, China and Vietnam were mentioned. And I also see a slow opening to this region among my colleagues in Vienna, who are Eastern Europeanists. So this is probably a broader tendency in this area. Less often mentioned, and here also not taken up, was Cuba. And one could add other Latin American countries. However, more or less totally left out are African countries. And I would argue that here a kind of a similar or part of this ambivalent orientalizing attitude is at stake. So there would be either a test not to be, you know, really or seriously socialist enough to be talked then about also as post-socialist, respectively culturally too different. So if there are similar processes detected, for example, in values and practices among co-workers during privatization processes, they are differently interpreted, scholarly interpreted. So either as, for example, kinship in Africa or solidarity in Poland. So thus, the second point I want to make here is that there would be still a potential in framing the term as less regional and more analytical. A comparison then could open up with such aspirations, could then, I would argue, still lead to new insights.
Thank you very much. Let's add a historian's perspective. Juliane.
That was, I must say, really mind-opening, and I will try to incorporate your Orientalist analysis because I must say I was quite taken by it, but obviously it's a new thought for me. I start with some Samma-Kritiker, with some self-critique as a good socialist. Even though I am indeed running a project called The Legacies of Communism, I actually think it is a misnomer. I think post-communism cannot exist because communism obviously was the utopia which was supposed to be achieved by socialism. And while several leaders, including Stalin, Khrushchev and Brezhnev, all declared socialism to be achieved, nobody actually ever dared to have communism achieved. I think Khrushchev went as far as to say our grandchildren will live under communism, but that was about as close as it could get. And I am a stickler for terms, so I really don't like the term post-communism, so that leaves me with post-socialism. And that's one I like to play around with. And actually, since I don't want to be only negative and self-critical, I do have two terms which I have come across over the last few years, which I do like. One of them is still socialist. Still socialism, and the other one is not yet capitalism. And I think it shows, I mean, historians tend to like years and then they like to dissolve years, and I very much belong to that category. Clearly, I mean, actually, one of the fascinating things about the end of the Soviet Union is how unremarkable it was, how there was so little difference between the 31st of December 1991 and the 1st of January 1992. There were no street demonstrations. There were not even great ceremonies. I think Gorbachev in his memoirs remembers how he basically leaves the Kremlin and there's not even anybody to say goodbye to him. He just packs his stuff and leaves. And that for the country which has shaped the 20th century to an unprecedented degree. So clearly socialism did not end at midnight and that particular point. And the question is then, obviously, so what is socialism then? What did end and what did not end? So clearly the state ended, the infrastructure ended. I agree it cannot be a geographic term. I also, however, think it cannot be a strictly defined chronological term. And that brings me to, obviously, my own work as a historian who is particularly interested in the subjective experience. And that is why I find your term Orientalist so interesting, because I was just wondering, do any of the people I study, or do actually anybody who has lived through that break ever describe themselves as socialist and post-socialist? I mean, I can come up with other terms like soft key, derogatory terms, or performative terms, like when you get up at an assembly and you say, we are in the socialist brotherhood. Clearly then the term is used, but it's actually almost absent, I would say, from the everyday language. And yet, on the other hand, we operate with it as if it's an absolute given. So this is why I sort of like these kind of fudging terms of still socialist, not yet quite capitalist, because actually if one looks at the last 30, 40, well, let's say 30 years since about the end 70s, early 80s, clearly there were a lot of things that were going on in these countries. And I speak with more reference to the Soviet Union because that is where my specialty is and this is where I feel more comfortable making claims. But clearly certain elements of socialism fell away before socialism as a state form ended. Most and foremost, I would say, actually the faith. I mean, if you compare a book which has made big waves this year, Sloskin's House and the Embankment, where we really still operate with at least a leadership which he calls the faithful, he compares them to millennials. I think it would be very hard to find an equivalent community in the 70s, 80s, even in the leadership. Actually, ironically, of course, most likely around Gorbachev and idealists wanted to reform. But even there are certain very crucial elements of the faith, like the idea that the party is indeed the embodiment of truth, have fallen away. I think also if you look at practices, a lot of practices basically fall away, which are, we consider quintessentially socialist, which are built up as socialist in the 20s, 30s, and then again very strongly with help of the Second World War and of the Great Fatherland Wars, I think is already an indicator. They sort of give way to multiple practices. So you can be a good socialist and sort of like your little vegetable garden in the dacha and maybe sometimes read Solzhenitsyn on the sly, and still that wouldn't make you a traitor in a way how it would have made you an enemy of the people in the 30s and 40s. So clearly there's more leeway of what it means. And then, of course, the more leeway there is, the question is, does it actually still mean anything? So the faith isn't required anymore to participate. And then, of course, all these sort of little things which develop and which actually are quintessentially socialist, like the black market economy, the trade in Beatles tapes, the obsession with jeans. I mean, I'm talking about my own research here, but these are all things which actually we now consider as quintessentially belonging to the time of socialism, even though they're not socialist, and they do very much end with socialism, because suddenly you had lots of jeans on the market and you could get Beatle tapes and you didn't have to sort of listen to the jammed voice of America, but you could just tune in. So there's a whole host of things which actually stop being socialist in this sort of puritanical sense, but are socialist because they become the practices which are happening. And these practices, of course, then often do survive the collapse of the socialist regime precisely because they're not linked to the infrastructure. So, well, obviously, there was no membership in the Komsomol or the Communist Party anymore, especially after the party, I think, is more complicated, but the Komsomol literally ceases to exist in 1991. A lot of course, the networks, the way how people interacted, the way how they perceived hierarchies, all these things which have developed under the big umbrella of where they were, the ideological canon, they, of course, could survive. And this is what I would call the still socialist, apart from the fact, of course, that we have a lot of visual evidence. I mean, spaces don't change overnight. People don't change overnight. So Moscow pretty much looked the same on the 1st of January than it did on the 31st of December. And then still, in fact, it did for a while. And then, on the other hand, you have what I call not yet capitalist, but here already, I mean, come into a more troubled legacy insofar as capitalism, of course, is only one facet of what it meant to be alive in on the 1st of January 1992. But I think that actually is a term that comes more out of the experience of the subject, because that's definitely a term which I think is invoked very often, unlike socialist. So we actually, I think, have to think about that term too, to a certain extent, because it's so much an equivalent of the post-socialist condition in the way how it is used by actual people. So all I do is basically mess up old terms and offer some dodgy alternatives. But I think it's these kind of questions we have to ask ourselves before we sort of embark in speaking then even about the legacies of post-communism. One has to first entangle what actually are the legacies of socialism, and do they actually have to, what is the definition of socialism we use in that fact. And I think I'll stop here.
Thank you very much. And we add a political scientist perspective to this. Margarita.
Thank you. Being the last in the first round gives me the chance to be a little bit smarter than I was 10 minutes ago, and perhaps the chance to be a little bit shorter. But this is a great opportunity to reflect on terms that we very often use without really thinking what we really mean. And I am the first person who is using, especially in talking, this concept in a very unreflective manner. So thank you, Gwen, for bringing us together and forcing us to think about this. I would like to start this round just by giving you a general feeling of what kind of strikes me as useful or unuseful or not useful in different terms. Maybe later I'll have the chance to tell you more about what I think we can build upon. But one term that I think it's very problematic is transition, because it implies a theological idea of transition to something very concrete. And we know 30 years down the road that something has been very different. There is not one that something. So I find that very problematic, which also means that, unfortunately, I'm going to be disagreeing a little bit with your idea of not still yet socialist, not still capitalist, because then, in a sense, that also implies one view of capitalism. But most importantly, I feel that different variations of the idea of transition or not still and not yet perhaps make us think in zero-sum games about the connection between socialism and capitalism. And actually, and maybe I'll get the chance to talk more about this in the next round, I feel some of the more exciting concepts are concepts that force us to think about the different ways in which different parts of that pre-1991 reality recombine and remain connected in different ways. So it's not so much leading something to move into something, but a reconnection and rebuilding. Maybe I'll get the chance to talk more about that later. Concepts such as post-socialism, I use that all the time, but it's actually not very useful because what was socialism? Again, was it what leftists all over Europe and the world consider to be socialism? It's a very broad term, and even more so when we talk about post-communism. As you said, nobody, not even the great Soviet leaders, believed that communism had been achieved, not to speak of post-communism. So I find that a little bit problematic. The term post-Soviet, at least when we are actually talking about former republics of the Soviet Union, I find that perhaps not very sexy, but useful, because it makes us think back about a concrete institutional system, very concrete, we can kind of get our hands to a great extent onto what it was, and a system we can see how it affected what would happen afterwards. Just to give you one example, the way the Soviet Union worked in terms of the power or not power of different union republics, as union republics, as potential civic nations, and how that of real policy-making power this union republic institutions had vis-a-vis either central institutions or informal institutions. That is something that the concept of post-Soviet can help us understand better than the concept of post-socialist or, for God's sake, post-communist. For example, if we look at the way in which union republics actually had very little control over key industries, not only in the energy field, but in a couple of other fields, were directly controlled by sectoral branch ministries in Moscow. At the same time, you had ministries at the level of the union republics. In different cases, they had different powers. In other cases, they were, to quote an author writing in the early 2000s, many cases they were just mailboxes for receiving instructions from Moscow. But at the same time, you had a really existing system of networks. And what does this all mean for states after 1991? The Union Republic is left with very little policy leverage because it never had control of key industries. And on the other hand, those networks that were existing already from pre-1991 continue to be strong. And I have seen that many, many times, not only on the example of pipeline networks, refineries, and now metallurgical companies, which I have been studying in the last years, but in other areas as well. So I think, to wrap it up, the more concrete that term is and the more it allows us to really get back to something concrete institutionally that we can get hold of, the more useful is it going to be.
Okay, thank you. So if it's possible to sum up, which it isn't, I think we established that political scientist. I count myself among them, so I share what you said, that I think that discipline in particular has been lazy about using terms like post-communism. So I think it also shows which disciplines are a bit more reflective about the terms they use and the history that goes with these terms, or maybe definitely for historians, but also for an anthropologist, if you focus on practices, you're immediately, I think, entering the discussion at a different level. So I think it also says something already about disciplines and their approaches. And I also sense transition wasn't a very popular term for reasons that you outlined very clearly. So we seem to be a little stuck with socialism and post-socialism. We've also established socialism means different things, and it's good to clarify, do we mean the system? Do we mean a mindset, practices? What are we actually talking about? I think over the whole discussion hovers potentially an even larger question, but we have to be very succinct. And I will pose the question to you, Juliana, as a historian. I mean, how should we even think about legacies? I mean, what are legacies? As a historian, I'm sure you find it highly amusing when political scientists plug into their equation legacies or socialist country. This is how the discussion started. I think also in political science, it has become much more nuanced than that. And it's also how we think about the diversity of starting points and outcomes that has moved along a lot. But nevertheless, I'm sure you come at it with a different view. And please tell us how we should understand legacies. And maybe you can link it immediately to how can we make this perhaps also the step from understanding what could be certain legacies from maybe not just 89, but maybe, as you said, it started earlier. And can we and should we think also of 30 years, bringing a temporal horizon into it, as a period that has now also led to created its own legacies, never mind if they were exactly linked to socialism or something else?
Well, thanks. Thanks for hitting me with that question. And as Gwen well knows, I too have dabbled in political science, which probably made me a historian. That gives me a chance to clear up, which I think might be a little bit of a misunderstanding of that term, still socialism, not yet capitalism. I actually meant that very much as a facet of certain lives. And that sort of actually brings me to the question about legacies. As a historian, I would always say that everybody's experience, every subjective experience is fragmented. And it's absolutely possible to have even contradictory experience of one and the same person, let alone of one and the same group, let alone of a large number of people living in a diverse space, ranging from basically Berlin to Vladivostok. So when I speak of still socialist, which would be sort of hitting onto the question of legacies, there clearly are things in everybody's life who lives in these spaces which are post-Soviet, post-people's democracies, in this geographical space, where they're on a daily basis, they're reminded or they enact something which is still linked to experiences which either they themselves or their parents have assembled and experienced under the socialist states. And I think that if one goes down, and I'm a historian who really likes working on the individual level, I think one really has to go down to the individual and see what are these things, because they're not the obvious things always. I mean, clearly, I think there are very few. I mean, in the Soviet Union or in the ex-Soviet Union, you have people who still vote communist and clearly still have either remained or resurrected a certain bit of communist faith or communist ideas. But I think the real legacies are actually the ones which are more subtle. And I think a lot of that has to do with how people understand terms, how vocabulary is used, which I think is very useful to start the whole discussion with a question of what is the vocabulary we use and how does this actually reflect or not reflect or supersede vocabulary which is used by the people we study. And I mean, of course, when we think of legacies of socialism, legacies of communism, we very quickly also then start doing a sort of kind of comparative history, which I think can have its dangers, but of course it is also useful, because what actually gives us that benchmark of what might be socialist if it's not looking, I mean, if it's not straight out of Marx, Engels or Lenin, but we still somehow think it is socialist, what gives us the benchmark? And of course the benchmark is the West. So in a way, I think that comparative look is justified. One has to use it very carefully. And I think, therefore, quite often it is interesting to see how do people understand certain key terms which have defined the last 30 years, like democracy, like freedom. I mean, I find the term freedom is an incredibly interesting term to look at, how that mutated, but how freedom is still defined, I would say, by many people in ex-socialist states in that abstract of the freedom of state intervention and regime policies, which I think is very different how freedom resonates in the West. So that's just, I mean, I don't want to go down to concrete examples because then one has to explain everything, but in great detail without being too generalistic. But I think the idea of terminology, how people use and understand terms which govern their sense of belonging in society is a really important one if one looks at legacies. I'm not an anthropologist, but I think historians sort of like to dabble in all sorts of disciplines. I myself am also very interested in practices, and I think practices are and rituals are an extremely powerful way of keeping legacies, which do not necessarily, again, have to be ideologically loaded, but can have their roots or can have achieved their meaning in the time of Soviet Union or other socialist states. I mean, I attended the panel on Lviv just before. And clearly, even things which look super new, like the new nationalist rhetoric or the veneration of Stepan Bandera, actually, of course, these processes were put in motion precisely because of other policies during socialist times. So again, it's not that they look socialist per se, but they are leftovers of times when precisely this discourse was the most provocative thing one could do. So, I think terms, practices and memory, of course, legacies are also a subjective experience, and especially as a historian of subjectivities, I would really have to subscribe to that. I think what people remember as being socialist, of course, also matters, no matter if that is de facto something they have experienced or really was part of their socialist lives. I mean, the Spreewald Gherkins, I think, are a famous example of having been made a quintessentially GDR item by the film Goodbye Lenin. They were, of course, there beforehand, but I have a hunch, and I don't actually have empirical data on it, but I have a hunch that their prominence as a socialist icon really is a post-socialist phenomenon. I think there are several things. And as we all know, that's not even a conscious process. I mean, I think as somebody who does a lot of oral history, it is really fascinating to think about what we know in terms of science, of how memory works, how every time we recount something, we overwrite memory. And de facto, maybe possibly what is really important in terms of legacies is not actually what one can trace as a de facto existence, but what is the perceptive of what is there, and no matter how, if it is positively or negatively coded.
Thank you. Tatiana wanted to come in, and maybe you can also link it a bit to, if you weren't going to do this, to the question of how you think about legacies or how you think we should start thinking about legacies.
Yeah, thank you. That was actually my idea, to come at the point of legacies, because I think it's interesting that again, talking about legacies, we kind of seem to swim on the empirical level. So what I wanted to point to in my introductory words was actually that there is a legacy of our, we have a scientific legacy in our way to conceptualize whatever it is, practices, terms and so forth. And while it might be very good if a concept or the value of a concept is kind of increasing, if its content is more clear. So the second argument I made is that the concept of socialism or post-socialism has an unrecognized content, which is the region. So if we talk now about the empirical legacies in people's practices, way of thinking, way of relating, I would say from my observation, there are very similar things going on, for example, in Tanzania, but they are not acknowledged. So the term is kind of limited in its analytical value to a region, which I think is problematic. It can also travel in another way. So if we put more stress on the kind of intellectual or scientific legacy of a concept, I think it should travel back. By this, I mean that if the reflexivity of anthropology or other disciplines allow us to question our concepts at the example of post-socialist societies, and you named a few, democracy, freedom, and could add civil society, I guess, and others, I think it's not only that the comparative point should be the West, but to see how this can help us to develop a kind of a, I guess, better theory, in a way. I leave it here for the moment.
Okay, if we can go back to you, Margarita, because you highlighted, I think, an important dynamic in the discussion about legacies, that something is coming apart and something is coming together or is being built. So also this is an active notion that something in legacies aren't just lying around there and then they do their work, as one could think if one thinks of, okay, what factors explain something, and then we can't really perhaps think of what it really is, and we say, well, then it must be legacy. So I think there was a certain trend in social science research to go down that road. And now we've become, I think, more nuanced, and you pointed to the fact that it's agency that matters. No? Some institutions might exist on paper and exist in a certain form in reality, and something happens to them. So I think this highlights a more general point that legacies, once we've defined them, need to be activated and something happens to them for them to matter. And maybe that gives you the opportunity to unpack a little what you meant beyond the example of the Soviet Union falling apart, what you meant by something comes apart and dissolves or also is reassembled. I think you tied it to institutions. I think now a lot of political scientists also look at how legacies of different kinds might affect the individual and individuals' perceptions. But maybe you have a preference for sticking to institutions. Maybe you can unpack that dynamic a bit more for us.
Okay, I will try. So one key point I was trying to get at a few minutes ago is that we need to think not of socialism and capitalism as separate animals, so to speak, but we need to think about what happens after 1989 or 1991 as a unique recombination of different elements existing both cases. And this takes us back to institutions, to institutional elements, but it also takes us back to the issue of how institutions actually worked, even when this was different from the way they were supposed to work. For example, we often talk about the legacy of central planning. But actually, when we think about the legacy of central planning, we also need to keep in mind that central planning did not work always as expected, and very often needed a little or a bigger push from institutionalized or less institutionalized practice, such as the Talchaki and the people who were going around the Soviet Union trying to help central planning a little bit to work in terms of organizing supplies and organizing deliveries. So we need to think about the legacies not only of the formal institution, let's say Gosplan or Gossnab, but we need to think about the legacies of the way in which it actually worked and how those legacies have been combining in different ways, how in many cases those legacies are mobilized or instrumentalized verbally, discursively by different actors for other goals. So you end up with a much more complex, almost kaleidoscopic picture of the situation. I would like to add one comment, perhaps it's an example of this, having to do with the word infrastructure, because it was used before, and it really makes me understand that we may use this word very differently in different disciplines, and even within one discipline, one can use infrastructures to mean more material legacies or more mental infrastructure legacies. But as a person who has wasted many hours dealing with pipelines, I have encountered the word infrastructure many, many, many times. So I wanted to emphasize that, at least from my perspective, the infrastructures did not go away. What did go away was the governance system that made those infrastructures kind of work within that system. What went away was the governance of union-wide markets that made those infrastructures viable. So when we are talking about energy, be it in Lithuania, in Ukraine, in Belarus, for example, if we are talking about oil refining, all these three states inherited an oversized energy system, and in particular an oversized oil refining system that made sense within a situation where you not only had the infrastructures to move those barrels of crude oil and those volumes of refined oil products to other places, but a system that made sense by providing those markets. So what you may have is some infrastructures remaining, but no longer the governance relationships that make them work. So I want to leave it at that for now, but I want to emphasize again that it's not about one or the other, is about the recombination of different elements and actors explicitly and actively instrumentalizing these concepts. Even the concepts of a unified infrastructure, even the concept of quote-unquote natural monopolies concerning gas, for example. So the individuals who are instrumentalizing and activizing this concept for a variety of goals are also very important.
Thank you. Maybe we can pick up one thing that seemed very important to me, and you made it right at the beginning, so maybe we should kind of end maybe this discussion up here on coming back to that point, because you rightly picked up, which I wanted to pick up as well from this morning's discussion, a comment one can hear a lot in maybe non-academic discussions: does it really matter? Who cares what we call this thing or the legacies? And I think you said, but maybe so briefly, that you need some more time now to respond to it again. I think terms have an effect, and they shape not just our academic discussions, then that wouldn't be maybe so dangerous, but they also have political consequences. And how do you see this? I mean, you talked about some comparisons already with maybe African countries, for example. So that suggests we are not seeing other similarities. At the same time, one probably also want to be careful what we compare, and we don't have time to go into that. Sort of, it can also become too loose. But I think you hit on an important point, that we don't see certain questions or similarities or differences because we think through a particular lens, and that is political or a geographical lens. But then there's also a question behind that: how did this happen to this region? I mean, how did this term become the region in a geographical and temporal aspect? And many other regions that have experienced change, political, economics, social change, and we don't have, as far as I know, equivalent terms. We go back, and that might not always work either, to geographical regional descriptions, but that's a very different dynamic. So I was wondering if you could tell us a bit more about what you think are the political consequences of our thinking about post-socialism.
Thank you for giving me this opportunity. It's a little bit a complicated argument because it needs, you know, like shifting the way of thinking, and I'm not sure that I can do it in such a quick time. But to put it very crudely, I think the legacy of this conceptual tools with which we worked is the political situations we are now in, where we see what is widely called populism, autocracy, whatever was this morning was debated, if European values are on the, you know, limited and so forth. So I think that is partly, or that is a legacy, because concepts are not only, and I think concepts are then good, not if they're as concrete as possible, but if they make us see things which we haven't seen before. And this can be different concepts at different times. So, but they are not, you know, attached to a reality out there, but they shape the reality. Now, in this concrete case, what I wanted to point to is that the analysis of socialism as a kind of a deficient institutional set of aspects, to put it very, very broadly, this then contributed to the urgent search for theories that could be, you know, translated into policy. And there was this theory, which I mentioned, like modernization theory, and this is, of course, again, an umbrella term, but with the idea that we can change this, and what we need to do is to change the economic institutional framework. Now, this theory had failed before in producing the results, the expected results, as I quickly, you know, mentioned, in post-colonial countries. So then the post-colonial countries are kind of given up. They are too different. It just doesn't work. So they are not the same. They are culturally different. They are mentally different, whatever. Now, what I think is surprising, with hindsight, of course, that we see a rapid parallel development in thinking. So we have something where a stress on the economy and an economic analysis in relation to socialism, title that capture that, it's the economy of shortage. So it doesn't work. So that is why people want something different. And I leave, there's also, of course, a political side. I don't want to make it too complicated. Now, we have then this breakup of the Soviet Union and a quick change, and we are looking for concepts. And so there is a kind of return to this modernization theory with those concepts, and we think now we can implement it, because especially in Europe, the Eastern Central European countries, the citizens are basically the same. They are Europeans. They are just as we are, and if in the colonies it didn't work, it will work here. And then it very quickly turns out that the results are not as expected. So there is a deep frustration and so forth, so economic results, and we had all the statistics this morning for how long it took for some of the economies to recover. And then all of a sudden, it's again, it's not the institutions, but it's the people. So it's a kind of shifting the blame to the people who are then essentially different. They are now post-socialist citizens with legacies of behaving differently, networking differently, looking at hierarchy differently, having different values. So it's kind of that there was a deficiency before, and through the conceptual tools that we have, we replicated a deficiency analysis of what we see today until we end up by still comparing these Eastern people with these Western people and always coming up with there is a difference. They don't think about liberal values as we do. So, okay. And then I'm coming back to my first sentence. And all of this, I think, has basically fed into what we see as a political situation now. And I think we need better concepts. I don't think that there's an ideal solution, but it is high time to think conceptually different. Of course, social science should produce some kind of surplus value, to bring a Marxist term. And part of that might be that indeed we don't feel as such, and we are unaware of specific structures, legacies, and so forth. And that is something that why social sciences actually exist and should exist hopefully sometime in the future, by developing concepts that are useful for the topic research. But also, it might be, even if I'm in a research area where a specific topic or a specific term is not used, to translate it into that context again in order to see things which I haven't seen before. Terms like which are very specific for a specific discipline, like kinship in anthropology, might help to understand migration different. Post-socialism as a temporal term might make us see migration different, and so forth. So I think there is a cross-fertilization and a suppressed value, and that is what we are looking for.
I think that's a nice final sentence for our discussion, because it's really about the use of concepts, so also flawed concepts, and I think probably every concept is ultimately flawed, makes us realize certain things and starts a discussion if we're willing to be reflective upon it. And maybe it seems that we've come to a point where at least we can all agree, I think, and also across disciplines, that socialism didn't mean the same thing everywhere. So something to assume that therefore the starting point was exactly the same is flawed. And we've seen, and also in this morning's panel, we've seen how much diversity we spot also since the end of socialist systems, at least. So I'm not quite sure we are certain how we can find our way through this complexity, but I think we'll continue working on it and we'll think of follow-up events on this discussion, which I've thoroughly enjoyed. So thank you very much to the three of you.